You're listening to Paranormal Portal on Revolver Podcasts. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Paranormal Portal. I'm your host, Brent Thomas. Guest tonight is Mr. Brooks Agnew, and he's already hitting the ground running with this amazing knowledge and understanding of the physical world around us. And I mean, it's so profound to hear. Not only is there a probability that the Earth is hollow, but that there is a possibility that there could be life in there. And by not hollow, I don't mean to say hollow, but there's a possibility of another biosphere existing with underneath our feet that could support life on its own, independent of us, and perhaps, you know, intermingling with us.
Or choosing their absence from us.
Yeah, well, can't say I blame them for that. Not like we've got it all together up here on the crust, but...
I like the way you say possibilities. That's what we're all about. Right. You know, my colleagues and I, we talk about this stuff until we run out of air, and we're always talking about the possibilities. One of my good friends lectured for a long time, wrote some amazing books. His name is Amit Goswami. He's a lecturer. He's a professor for a long, long time. And he always talks about the possibilities. He really taught me to enjoy that word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, clearly, I think one of the beautiful things about this is that, and this is something that I would have expected, is that having the kind of grounding that you do within the scientific principle and understanding that in a lot of cases it seems to be at odds with a spiritual reality. But I think that, you know, as we move forward, there's not so much, a this or that principle, that more people are maybe becoming a little more holistic about understanding and finding understanding in, you know, through science to complement their spiritual realities, I guess is the best way I can.
I hope so. I know the secret to life is clean glassware and conversion factors. If I could just get people to understand that, we'd have world peace. I just know it.
That's what's in my bottle. I understand that. Sugar is a wonderful thing.
So, you know, I would like to take a few minutes in since, you know, again, it's one of those things where I want to cover as much ground as we possibly can with you. But, you know, what do you think about the whole concept? And this comes up a lot in the disclosure movement as if one of the benefits of the disclosure movement, they believe, would be the opening up of these ideas for free energy or having, you know, the ability to generate energy at any place. And a lot of these ideas seem to center around tapping into the magnetosphere of the Earth and being able to resonate with that and create energy. Is there any, as you understand it, are any of these principles or theories sound, or is it a lot of smoke and mirrors? What's going on there?
Well, of course there's smoke and mirrors, but it depends on what you're talking about. You know, when we tend to think in our society about energy, we tend to think about the power lines and the transformers, and you know, we spin up generators to make 161,000 volts. We put it out on aluminum lines that goes out to substations. It's stepped down through a series of transformers, divided and divided and divided, which increases the current and allows us to spread it out to a whole bunch of houses in parallel. And that's the way we think about energy.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking at several breakthrough energy conferences around the world, I have said, you know, the guy that brought us here, Nikola Tesla,
mm-hmm.
he introduced a principle that the powers that be, the masters of the universe, so to speak, have ignored since day one. You guys all want to do three-phase, high voltage. You want to tie it together in a grid from California to New York so that you can, you know, move energy around like water in pipes, and you want to meter it and sell it. And not only that, you want society, you force society to live along your wires.
Mm-hmm.
So if I look at the United States from space, I can see the wires from space. I can see where people congregate based on the way you distribute this energy.
Sure.
And that distribution has created a lot of problems, because mankind was not meant to live in groups of 3 million people. We're meant to be agrarian. We're meant to be to spread out in small communities. You know, we're meant to decentralize, not centralize.
Hmm.
So that's the way we try to approach energy. We went back to the basics and said, look, why don't we rediscuss low voltage, local supply?
Sure.
How about no more power lines, no more nuclear power plants, no more hydroelectric dams, no more coal-fired plants spinning up, you know, 20-foot diameter generators to make electricity? Why don't we generate the electricity at the other end, like at the house or at the hospital or the police station or the individual traffic light?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't need to connect anything, to make a traffic light turn on.
Nope.
All you really need are two dissimilar magnets and a copper plate to make the gas inside of a light. The electrons around the gas inside a light to fluoresce.
Yeah.
You don't need any electricity at all. You could just make the magnetic field make the gas inside these lights fluoresce. It'll put off light, no electricity up to it at all. And it will do it virtually forever until the gas you know, changes
off.
State inside the tube.
There you go.
So all you need is a traffic light that moves the magnet back and forth to turn the light on or off, or a shutter over the light. Just let the light burn all the time and just shutter the light, or put a liquid crystal in front of it to turn it on and off. Something that runs on almost no energy at all. Maybe 6 volts or 4 volts.
Mm-hmm.
You see, this is the kind of technology that's out there, but it isn't used because it's not connected to that grid.
It's not paying the big dividends.
We propose.
It's not paying the big dividends.
Well, of course. I mean, if I showed you a way to light every room in your house, and you don't even have to change light bulbs, you can go to Lowe's and you can buy the regular old little pigtail, you know, the little swirly fluorescent tube that you plug in that now replaces the incandescent bulb.
Mm-hmm.
You could take that bulb, place it in between 2 wire-wound neodymium magnets, sticking off the end of ferrous magnets on copper plates, and that light will light. You don't have to plug it into anything. You could light every room in your house virtually forever without using a single milliwatt of energy.
Wow. That's
But that's just lighting. So again, you're not going to be able to air condition your house with that kind of energy. You're not going to be able to cook with that energy. You're not going to be able to pump water from 300 feet below the ground up to your water system in your house with that kind of energy. But there are other forms of almost, I'm not going to say free energy, okay, but very efficient energy,
okay,
that you can generate using sunlight, using wind, using geothermal, using, you know, even the magnetism of the earth, if you have enough area to stretch the wire.
Really?
Okay. Or if you have a moving body of water like a river or wind blowing, you can use, you know, the dynamo effect and gather, induce a current flow in the wire that way, up to 200 volts. But again, this is low voltage,
right,
local supply,
mm-hmm,
right, unmetered, which means man could live, you know, the way we were designed to live in, right, social groups instead of super cities.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That, and that to me is just profound as hell. And actually, there's a video going around on Facebook that shows the exact, mm-hmm, experiment you're talking about.
Exactly.
That's of the neodymium magnets being wrapped in wire and then put on two ferrous magnet as well, and then sitting on top of
you have to have the dissimilar magnetic fields, or you don't get the movement, you don't create the focused flux lines that excite the gas inside the tube. This won't work with LEDs. This won't work with incandescent bulbs, but it will work with mercury vapor, which is what's inside those bulbs.
Right, the fluorescent, okay, yeah, fluorescent bulbs, yeah.
Yeah, and the guy shows it, and of course, you know, I've seen many of the con videos that are out there on YouTube about the free energy and people mounting little pancake batteries in these, you know, look like bulbs and putting them by these weird wiring contraptions. And right, then, you know, and of course people are buying it hook, line and sinker because, you know, we want to believe that this is possible, but it's good to hear that that demonstration that I saw on that Facebook video is, yeah, that is valid because that's exactly what you just described.
Well, you still got I mean, you're not talking very much energy. You're talking maybe 20 watts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It, not even that, really, because you're not really exciting the gas with the starter that's in the bulb.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking a very, very small amount of power. And, of course, I think the light that you see on that video, it's greatly exaggerated by the camera.
Oh, okay.
Because it's not very bright. It's not nearly as bright as that bulb will burn if you plug it in.
Okay.
Because the starter is gonna make that liquid piece of mercury go to gas inside those tubes, and then that's gonna vibrate the electrons somewhere in the neighborhood of 290, maybe 300 nanometers, which you definitely don't want to look at.
Mm.
But what that does is it excites the dope, that's what we call it, dope, on the inside of the glass.
Okay.
And that dope on the inside of the glass is what takes the short UV, the UVC that's inside that bulb. It's what we call germicidal UV. And it makes the dope fluoresce in the visible light range. Oh. So it's a much more safe wavelength you could be exposed to for long periods of time without any problem. It's way up close to 400 nanometers, so it's visible white light. It's a broad spectrum of light, depending on what kind of dope is inside the glass. But it's exciting with a mercury vapor on the inside.
Hmm. So you had also talked about having enough area to run a wire around a property in order to tap into the magnetic field as well. I don't know. Is it possible to explain that, or is that something that would be just too intricate to explain how that type of generating would work?
Well, I mean, the electromagnetic effect is that when you have a moving magnetic field, you induce a current flow in copper wire or in any kind of metal.
Uh-huh.
So the theory is with enough rounds of wire and a long enough, basically, antenna, you're going to pick up the magnetic fluctuations in the earth around you, just say 10 acres. If you were to run, I don't know, say a couple of miles or 3 miles of wire around and around and around on poles, you'd pick up those magnetic fluctuations and it would induce a current flow in that wire just through the dynamo effect.
Okay.
I don't know how reliable it would be, but I think the voltage, you know, could be substantial. You'd have to have a way to store it when the magnetic fluctuations are significant, and then use that energy when the magnetic fluctuations are not.
So the Earth's magnetic field is not necessarily constant either. Then it's fluctuating quite a bit. Is what you're explaining?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's fluctuating all the time.
You know, what kind of an EMF field would that create within that perimeter of copper wire, do you think? Would that be harmful to a person?
Nope, because it's DC.
Ah, yeah, that's right. Yep.
There are certain frequencies that are more harmful than others. In fact, one of the most irritating to the human body is 60 hertz.
Right.
Which is remarkable why we even picked it. We've gotten used to 60 hertz, it's fairly easy to generate with a generator. That's why it's that speed or that frequency. But it also happens, if you go way back to the early televisions, they had a phosphorus screen.
Right.
And what would happen is the electron guns would shoot electrons at the screen and make the screen phosphoresce.
Right.
And that's what we see as the picture on the face of the glass. That's why when I was very young, my parents said, don't sit so close to that TV, that electron gun is shooting electrons, which it was.
Uh-huh.
But it had a flyback circuit. And a lot of people don't know this, but old TV tubes used to have a high voltage flyback circuit. It's like a ring around the picture tube.
Right.
So when the electrons would smack into the fluorescing or the phosphorescing screen, and rather than go through the glass, they would get sucked off to the sides in this flyback circuit.
Uh-huh.
And so the damage was minimal, especially if you stayed back about 10 feet away from the TV. But what happened was sometimes the frequency of the electricity would get down to about 40 hertz. And at 40 hertz, your eyes can see the flicker.
Right.
And so they increased it to 50 and then 60. And in fact, when computers first came out, their resolution was much better than a TV because you're sitting a lot closer to it. And so they flashed at 70 hertz so that you wouldn't see the flicker. Your brain wouldn't see the flicker and it wouldn't give you a headache.
Oh, my goodness.
When years ago, many years ago, when I was a line mechanic, I worked for Volkswagen when we had air-cooled engines. And Volkswagen, in their brilliance, I mean sheer brilliance, on the rear of the engine, of the air-cooled engine, when you're tuning the engine, it has a pulley that is the crank pulley. It's right on the end of the crankshaft.
Right.
And it's a stamped piece of steel that is the pulley. And it has flutes in it or grooves in the flywheel. Well, there were exact number of flutes in that flywheel so that if you were using fluorescent lights in your shop and you tuned it to 850 RPM, the flutes would stand still.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because of the 60 cycles from the lights. You were basically using the fluorescent lights as a strobo tack on the engine.
Yeah.
And you could tune it to exactly 850 RPM.
To hell with timing chain timers. You know, you were talking about, you know, going from 40 to 50 to 60 to 70 hertz. And you said that, you know, at 60 hertz, that's where it starts to actually do some damage. Or we start to notice it, shall we say. What kind of, I'm getting conspiratorial here. What kind of, why would they pick 60 hertz? Was that necessary?
Because that's the speed they can spin the generators at. These generators are big, you know, they're huge. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they can spin at about, because they're like 24 feet across.
Right.
You can't spin something like that at 1750 RPM.
Well, that would be true.
Right. Hmm.
because that brings in the question about how could things like that, you talk about the flicker of the old TV sets and things like that, that brings up so many conspiratorial things in my head, you know, from subliminal messaging to, you know, whatever else may be out there. But I digress. I'm so far off base right now.
Oh, it's fine. It's, you know.
Well, the whole reason they went to AC, alternating current, was because of the line loss on the wires. With DC, you'd have to have, you know, amplifiers and consume all kinds of energy in order to run it along transmission lines.
Right.
But that wasn't Tesla's idea. Tesla's idea was to have local receivers pick up the DC out of the air and just use it right there locally.
Right.
Oh. It wasn't supposed to transmit along lines and all the way across the city. That wasn't his original design.
He designed it.
But, of course, Westinghouse and Edison couldn't make money that way.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, because he designed it in each individual family or a compound, for lack of a better word, small community, would use its own power. Just like you said, you know, you wouldn't be able to power mega cities with these things. It would be just local.
Right.
Yeah, so, yeah.
I remember it was Tesla came up with AC, but then he later said, no, you don't want to use AC
it's too dangerous.
Because that's harmful.
Yeah.
And he tried to get them to go back to DC, but it was too late.
Yep. Wow.
It is just amazing. And you know, the ideas are just fantastic, though. But the ramifications of these things, even just creating your own free lighting in a house, could shed so much of a power bill for every family over the course of a year.
There would be no power bill.
Well, no, there would be, because you'd still need to run a refrigerator.
Lighting's not much.
Yeah.
Right. Lighting's maybe 1.5 kilowatts for a house.
Right.
It's not much.
Right.
The big energy is used in heating and air conditioning, water heaters, dryers, cooking. That's the thing that uses a lot of energy. Yeah. And, you know, the average house has a 200-amp service.
Right.
It rarely uses 200 amps all at once.
Right.
And sometimes the air conditioning is running, and you're heating water, and you're doing the laundry, and you're cooking, and your refrigerator's on all at the same time. And that's why the service has to be the size that it is.
Sure.
But in the 50s and 60s, houses had 60 amp service.
Wow.
60 amp. That's it.
Huh.
Wow. Houses didn't have central air. They had swamp coolers. They had fans. But people didn't demand that their houses stay 72 degrees year round. Now we do. It's, you know, we're creatures of comfort, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I am, for sure. I'm pretty guilty of that myself. It's like, oh, I'm sweating. Turn on something. But, you know, it's kind of the...
I'm kind of partial to wearing less.
Oh, God. You're getting all racy on me here. You might have to go to an unscheduled break.
If you go to Arizona, you know, not many people have heat pumps. And if you go to Arizona, most people have swamp coolers.
Swamp coolers.
Why? Yeah. Well, because the dew point is like 30 degrees. It's amazingly dry.
Uh-huh.
So a swamp cooler is very effective at cooling a house.
What is a swamp cooler?
Tennessee or Kentucky, a swamp cooler wouldn't work because the dew point is about 55 or sometimes 72 degrees.
What is a swamp cooler? I'm not sure I understand what this means.
It is a box that goes on your roof.
Okay.
And it sprinkles water over the filters, and then it has a fan, and it draws air in through the wet filters. The water evaporates, which cools the air, and then blows that cool air inside the house.
Right.
Oh. So even though it's 116 degrees outside, it can blow 60 degree air inside and provide moisture.
Oh, cool. Okay. I wasn't familiar with that term at all, but I've never had the luxury of living any place that didn't have winter. So not yet, anyway.
Well, they're all over the place in Southern California and Arizona and Nevada. They use swamp coolers a lot.
Wherever it's a dry heat, it's got to be a dry heat.
No, I would think ideas like that, the magnet setup that we were talking about in terms of illuminating fluorescent bulbs, you know, I saw there's this guy that has this company, and he's basically made this gravity light. It works on, you know, kind of like the old, as far as I understand, it works on the principle like the old grandfather clocks that you move up this weight, and over time it pulls down and generates electricity enough to light a bulb at night. I guess we're going to break. I will bring this back up on the other side. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back with Brooks and Agnew in the last half hour of the show. Don't go away. This is just nothing short of amazing. Gentlemen, we are back. This is the last half hour of our show, and it's gone screamingly fast. It always does here on the portal, but having done this for a couple years now, I'm kind of used to the fact that the show just kind of flies by, and I've gotten used to the pace of the show, even though it still sometimes surprises me. But tonight, it absolutely floors me. I mean, we've hit breaks, and I'm like, wait a minute, that can't be right. Yeah. So we've got a time paradox going on here tonight, and more so than normal, but it's the quality of the conversation. And, of course, that is thanks to our special guest tonight, Mr. Brooks Agnew. Again, Brooks, you've been amazing, and you definitely never disappoint.
Well, I like your idea about Hold on a second.
Okay.
Housekeeping?
I pulled the edge out of my ear. I like the idea about the potential energy, like the grandfather clock, where you pull the chain and raise the weight, and then over time the weight falls keeps the mechanism of the clock running, because it doesn't take very much to make the wheel go back and forth.
Right.
And I think that's a wonderful idea. We forget, when we're talking about free energy or over unity, that's a word I wish I never heard again. energy can be neither created nor destroyed.
Mm.
But if there is a way to convince energy to come into our experiment or our house or our thing that we want to light or heat or color or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the idea, if you really want to talk about minimalism, you really want to talk about using as little generated power that costs money as possible. What about in the old days, in the flats of some of these high-density cities, they used to have coin-operated meters. You could put coins into the meters, and it would give you energy for however much money you put in the wall. And then they would just come around and collect the money. I mean, that wouldn't work today because we're trying to, you know, get away from cash anyway. But it would work with debit cards or something like that, unless somebody didn't have any money, then they'd go cold. But what about wind-up appliances?
Sure, right.
You know, like you wind up a big mainspring inside the machine, and believe me, we have some bimetal springs that are incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And then using the spring energy of that wind-up to run a generator to make the energy that you need to run that particular machine, like toast a couple slices of bread or turn a light on. You know, you just have a little crank and you wind up the mainspring. And then that light will light for 30 minutes or an hour or 2 hours.
Right.
Why not?
Yeah, exactly. And it's these old concepts that have kind of gone the way of the dinosaur, but they're still relevant today, I would think.
We built a house out in the country one time because the country was cheap to live, and we could buy 2 acres of land for $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't have electricity out there yet. So what we did, we wired the whole house for 12 volts.
Yeah.
and we ran it on car batteries.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Every Monday, we would take the car batteries to the shop
and charge them.
And charge them all up.
Yep.
Wow.
And then, and it was enough energy, because we had like 20 of them in parallel. It was enough energy to run the lights for a whole week for the house and the radio.
What about the coffee pot?
But the coffee pot ran on a wood stove.
Well, there you go. Well, good thought.
There you go.
I keep thinking of Creature Comforts. I'm sorry. Cowboy coffee's just fine.
We didn't have air conditioning.
Right.
Sure.
Wow.
And we burned wood in the wintertime, which a lot of people are like, what? You burned wood, you polluter? Okay, well.
Okay, yeah. So let's talk about your oil heat there, pal.
Yeah, anywhere you generate electricity, it's using some kind of process that's got waste. So
coal.
We're coming to you from the north of Idaho, where, you know, wood burning is still a way of life up here.
I have a wood burning furnace in my house.
That's right. Yep. So
I live in Glen Ferry, so I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. Crazy. Now, what do you think of things like, just to try to squeeze another topic out of you in the last half hour, what do you think about concepts such as anti-gravity? Is there a way to cancel gravity that through electromagnetism, is it a matter of that? Or is there some other exotic process necessary to block gravitons, you know, to allow things like anti-gravity to exist, or, you know, I know gravitons are theoretical as well, but you know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm afraid gravitons and tachyons and all those things from Star Trek, they don't really exist.
Right.
Okay.
I do not know any way to cancel out gravity. I don't know a way to reverse gravity. Gravity is one of the five forces in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
I say five forces. We used to have four, which is the strong and weak molecular forces, gravity and electromagnetism. But increasingly, the physics community has been more open-minded to the fifth force in the universe, which Sir Roger Penrose and I wrote back and forth a couple times on, and that's consciousness.
Okay.
He once stated that consciousness was the result of quantum gravity. And I wrote back and said, I think you got it backwards. I think quantum gravity is the result of consciousness.
Huh.
So it's we're splitting hairs here. But when it comes to what is the first force in the universe, it's becoming more and more accepted that consciousness was the first force in the universe.
Hmm.
It's the primary force in the universe. So to say, is there such a thing as anti-gravity? Not that I know. In fact, I thought experiments that I run, I just don't know a way to do it. But I do know that if there is a way to focus gravity and aim it like a jet engine, we could use gravity for propulsion, which means you could use it to lift off of a planet.
Right.
I don't know that that's been done. There's no demonstration of this anywhere in the universe. All we really see are demonstrations of exactly the opposite. Mass attracts mass. But long before mass gets involved, electromagnetism is involved.
Oh.
Electromagnetism can keep bodies entrained, locked in an orbit of sorts, galaxies around galaxies, clusters of galaxies around clusters of galaxies, over billions of light years, which is impossible for gravity. And it's the reason why we invented dark matter and dark energy. We just said, look, the way things are moving in the universe, there's got to be more mass than what we can see. So we just created dark energy to make the math work out. But we don't really know for sure. It could be super bright energy for all that matter. It could be just beyond, you know, our realm to detect it. But I think more than likely, there's no such thing as dark energy. or dark matter. I think what we're dealing with is electromagnetism. Wow. It's more of an electric universe than it is a gravitational universe.
Ah. So ahead.
And the only...
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The only thing that... The only evidence I have to back that up right now is what we call backlighting, or that's the best way to describe it. We use bright objects out in the universe, like pulsars and quasars and incredibly bright stars. We use them as a backlight to look at the emptiness of space.
Right, right.
And what we see, of course, the vast majority of space is filled with gas. It's filled with all kinds of gas particles, metals and nonmetals and rare earth gases just out there. But the interesting thing about these gases is they align themselves along what appears to be flux lines in space, like fabric, like threads in space. They're not just, you know, filling up a balloon and randomly bouncing off the walls of the balloon. They're, even in the emptiness of space, they are organized. They are lined up, which means, or it indicates to us, that there are lines of force in the universe, and we believe those lines of force are electromagnetism.
Wow. That's crazy. I mean, in a good way. I'm not at all being mocking. I think that's nothing short of profound. But now, I had heard a physicist once postulate that gravity, her theory was that gravity originated in another dimension, and that's why it's not such a strong force here. Wow. Is there any possibility to that?
Well, you're cheating now. You're using the word possibility on me.
Well, you know, I don't know.
I have a weakness for it. But I'm going to say no. That's okay. Going to be my answer.
Okay. Well, and I agree. It seemed like a pretty fantastic idea to me.
Right.
Because at that point, if gravity can come through dimensional barriers, then, you know, are there really dimensional barriers? I don't know. You know, I don't know.
Well, no, there are things coming into our dimension from other dimensions. We can measure that. If you go to the laser interferometer gravitational wave observatories, I know that's a long title.
Wow. You
just put the letters LIGO. I say LIGO. They say LIGO. Okay, so it's LIGO.
I say we have a
show. There are two of them in the United States. One's in Hanford, Washington, up near you guys. You should go visit it.
Yep.
It's not far away.
Okay.
And then the other one's in Livingston, Louisiana. They're both pretty close to the same age. They were designed by Dr. Kip Thorne and Stephen Hawking. They've been in operation for a couple of decades. And the last time I went to the one in Louisiana, they were upgrading the fiber optics and the switchers between the servers. They had the fastest computers on the planet that I know of. They're faster than the ones on Wall Street, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And they also have the best laser control. And this is to say they can hold the wavelength of the light of the laser to very, very tight tolerances. No drifting of the wavelength. What these units are like giant laser framing squares. That's the best way I can describe them. It's a laser that's split in two, run down two legs of a right angle, and bounced off of a sapphire-coated mirror 4 kilometers away in a vacuum tube. 4 kilometers now. That means that those mirrors are many, many yards off the ground at the end of that tube because the laser goes straight and Earth curves. Correct, there are any flat earthers listening. but that laser light bounces back and forth a lot of times between those two surfaces to form a single laser light about 20,000 miles long.
Wow.
Then they tune one of the legs 90 degrees out of phase with the other one, and they cancel them out. So they interfere with each other. That's what's called an interferometer.
Oh.
And then they wait. And what they're waiting for is a ripple in space-time. Because the theory is that the light will travel in a straight line through space. But if space curves, the laser will curve with it. And when it does, it'll change in length, which will create a signal, a vibration at the sensor. So these instruments are now able to sense all the way down to the Planck length, 10 to the minus 33rd centimeters. That's incredibly sensitive. And what they are witnessing, according to Dr. Fred Robb that runs the one there in Hanford, I don't know if he's still there, but if you guys go there, you should go there. It's only a couple of hours away. What they're witnessing are particles, photons, popping into our dimension from another dimension. And that's a quote.
Wow.
So we do have information coming into our dimension from another dimension.
Wow.
Wow. So it really, really seems to prove the whole multiverse theory then? Would that be correct?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We figure that there's a limit on dimensions, probably, if you really want to think about it technically, about 26 dimensions.
Wow, okay.
But there's no limit on the number of universes.
Right. Wow. Okay. So universes go on and on and on and on. There's no end count of them. But in these multitude of universes, infinity, there are 26 possible dimensions of existence.
Yes.
Okay.
And some of those are academic, because we're talking about spins. We're talking about things that mathematically they are a dimension. But in reality, there's no place for energy or particles to exist in that dimension. So that's our definition of space. Space is void with energy and particles.
Okay.
And there's no place in the standard model for energy or particles to exist in many of those dimensions. But we can't just not say that those dimensions don't exist.
Huh. Now, I don't even know what to say to that, because
no,
it's like, as our awareness grows, do those dimensions then become potential? You know, I mean, is it a matter of transitional?
Like we deal with three dimensions pretty well. One dimension is a dot. Two dimensions is a line or a flat plane. But you know, it's basically a flat universe.
Right.
The periodic chart looks different. The molecules in it look different. But in the third dimension, we start with the tetrahedron, which is the first primary shape in the third dimension, and we get more complex from there.
Wow. I've never thought of a primary shape before. That's kind of an interesting thought.
It's all interesting.
Well, it is the basis of our universe.
Yeah,
I mean, trigonometry means, you know, triangle-ometry. It's all based on triangles. It's all based on tetrahedrons. All of the energy fields that we create, magnetic fields, all of our electrical science is all based on rotating tetrahedrons.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, when you talk about 60 cycles, we look at it as a 20,000-mile sine wave, but it's actually a circle. It's a circle. We're starting at the left-hand side at, say, let's say 9 o'clock. You're going positive up to 12 o'clock, right?
Uh-huh.
Then you're going negative down to 3 o'clock, then negative to 6 o'clock, and then positive up to 9 o'clock again. That's the sine wave. That's the propagation.
So funny. That is so awesome. Because that just ironclad another idea I had.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, that's why, you know, trigonometry and all the square root functions work so well in electricity.
Right.
You know, when you put a voltmeter on your wall socket, which you could do right now while we're live, they'll touch the metal leads. What voltage is it going to read?
It's going to read 12.
It's going to read 120 volts, right?
120, right, yeah.
But that's because the meter is reading root mean squared. It's not reading peak to peak.
Oh, yeah.
If it was reading peak to peak, it would be 169 volts. But we don't use the last little bit, the last 30%. We use 0.707. That's called root mean squared. That's the power that's in the sine wave. the top of it and the very bottom of it, the very tips of the top and bottom, negative and positive, they don't have any additional power because they're kind of going sideways. They're not going up and down. Right. They're going over the hill. Uh-huh. So we don't use that power. That's why everything is based on root mean squared. The voltmeter you put on the wall is a root mean squared meter. It doesn't measure peak to peak.
Right.
But if I were to full wave rectify that wave and measure the DC, it would be 169 volts.
Wow.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just a drooling mess again.
Okay,
but
yeah, here we go. We just got the beans baked again.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was cluing in. I was understanding, you know, hollow earth, the gravity thought about, you know, on walking on the inside of the mantle, you know, that kind of thing. I was digging that. Now I'm lost again.
You got all that, and where did I lose you? I lost you. Well, electromagnetism.
I don't think it's any one subject. It's just the volume.
Yeah, that might be it.
It's the volume of revelations that you've brought and that you bring, and that's why it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. Yeah, because absolutely. I mean, I was very serious when I said, you know, I just want to ask you this and that and this and that, because it's like, I don't know, it's kind of like having, you know, Santa show up in the toy room and you just want to get all the toys from him you can before he has to go. You know? And this is a rare and wonderful opportunity to talk to someone of your knowledge and learning. And
by the way, I want to get one thing in before we go.
Uh-huh.
The 6th to the 8th, I'm going to be speaking in Sedona, Arizona.
Oh,
so those of you that know X Squared Radio, I'm going to have a PayPal button up there in a few days, maybe this weekend. And for only 200 seats, these are going to sell out in about a week. So if you want to hear this lecture on remembering the future in Sedona, Arizona, there will be a button there for you to click.
And so, Brooks, in closing, we got a couple minutes left, 3 minutes, just about under 3 minutes. How can people keep in touch with what you're doing?
The easiest way is to go to X Squared Radio. I'm a TFR host on the air from 8 to 11 on Sunday nights live. But it's an easy website. I keep it short and concise. It's mobile friendly. That's where you can keep up with everything that I'm doing.
Well, that's fantastic. And again, I can't thank you enough for being here and sharing all of your knowledge and insights with us and thoroughly schooling us on the nature of our reality that we live in. It's so funny that, you know, it's like swimming in the ocean but never realizing there's the myriad of currents and other factors that are at work. So it's always like going to school when you're on, but it's an amazing experience. You're like the teacher I love to listen to.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I would love for you to come back.
You guys asked the best question. That's why it's interesting.
Well, I don't know about the best. I know you've been on quite a few shows as a guest, and of course you have your own show that's just mind-boggling. You know, I don't know. Maybe we just ask the more paranormal part of the question. I don't know.
Hey, all paranormal means is above normal.
Above normal. Woo-hoo. There you go.
There it is. Absolutely. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being here and being a part of the show. And, you know, please stay connected with us. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/paranormalportalradio. Yep. Make sure you like and subscribe on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/paranormalportal.
sports betting is sweeping across the country faster than the coronavirus, and Wagering Week is your antidote. I'm Tom Barton, and I'm a veteran sports analyst and respected sports handicapper who helped build ESPN's brand. I've been recognized and awarded by Pro Football Weekly and Gaming Today magazine as the honest handicapper. Let the other guys give you the same old boring sports talk with the same tired storylines. We'll give it to you straight here every Friday on Wagering Week. Don't gamble with other podcasts. Let Sports Garden Network's Wagering Week help your bottom line.